Right, can everyone hear me? Yeah, great. All right, well, first of all, just hello. My name is Radar Fostervold, as they said. I'm a third generation missionary kid who grew up in the small tribe in Paraguay, which is down in South America. And I've just recently been commended by an assembly in Chicago to go back to the same people I grew up with as a missionary. So right now I'm just visiting people, and I was at CMML, the Christian Missions in Many Lands headquarters down in near Belmar. Just thank you for opening some space for me to be here. And yeah, to kind of tell a little bit of the story of the ministry that's happening down in Paraguay, I have to tell a little bit of the context of the situation right there with the Ache. So the people that we work with are the Ache of Puerto Barra. So they're a small indigenous group from eastern Paraguay that my grandparents were working with as missionaries. My parents are still working with them, and now I'm going to help out right there. So, in case you're wondering, sorry, I'm battling a cold that's very persistent. In case you're wondering, Paraguay is right there in the middle of South America. It's this small country, many times called the heart of South America because it's right there in the middle. It's got about 7 million people, and the main language that they speak is Spanish, but also Guarani. Which is a indigenous language that everyone speaks as well. You might know the Kunkuls, the Kunkul family. Yes, they're about 4 hours, 5 hours away from us. So we've worked with them on many occasions as well. And they work with mainly the Paraguayan population in more very rural, poor parts of Paraguay, but we're on the eastern side, and we work with the Ache group. So back in the Ache used to be nomadic hunter-gatherers many years ago, and for centuries they were completely uncontacted. They had no idea of the outside world except for a few brushes with Paraguayan people, or maybe the Jesuits, they lived a relatively simple lifestyle. They didn't wear any clothes in the forest, which made sense because they lived in the very dense part of the forest, so yeah, it wouldn't last any time at all with the thorns and everything. And it was high canopy forest, so there was very little sunlight coming in, so drying clothes were just, it just would take days. Basically, it just rots. So, it's pretty just simple, just to be completely al natural. It was made a lot more sense because, especially, the Ache men were hunters. They would just dash into the jungle to capture the food that they needed. Right, one of them being. These were kind of the arrows that they had right there. And monkeys were one of the primary food sources. But it's not easy to catch them, so you have to just dive straight into a thicket. If there's a bamboo thicket, doesn't matter, you go in. And get scratched up, doesn't matter. You're searching for that food. And so they would hunt monkeys, and when they would, the men usually when they finished, they'd go back to the camp where the women were cooking, and they'd give the animals to them to prepare, and then they'd just sit down and start taking the thorns out of their feet. So very, very committed people to providing for their families. But they also were, gathered different other resources like fruits and palm heart. Palm heart is at the top of the palm tree. You can eat the center of it, the core. It's edible, and it's very, very tasty. And grub worms as well. I had a picture in there, but I forgot to include it. But they're actually very tasty. Some of them taste more like butter. And they would eat that all the time. But, I mean, the funny thing is, if you think about shrimp, don't they look kind of weird? If you, you know, or lobster, you know, they look kind of gross. It's just what you're used to. They live like this for many centuries. But this all changed around the 1950s when the forest was being destroyed. So starting in 1950 to 1999, around there or more, Paraguay experienced some of the highest levels of deforestation in South America's history. People would come in, mostly Brazilian, German immigrants that came in to clear-cut the forest for agriculture. The land was dirt cheap, and the soil is incredibly fertile, and people just came in and started settling in the area. And a lot of these were German, Brazilian immigrants who had basically nothing. And through a lot of this hard work, they started farming the land. And as you see, it's this red dirt. It's this clay almost. And you can get 3 harvests in a year. So it's very productive. And today, this is what the landscape looks like. It's a little bit like the Midwest. And today, Paraguay is the 5th largest exporter of soybeans in the world. We're right behind right behind Brazil, the U.S., Argentina, and India. And we used to be 4th, but India's really stepped up their game right now. So, yeah. So, very, very big changes. And this shows the rate of deforestation from between 1945 and 2005. And in just 40 years, it's more than 95% of it is completely gone irreversibly. And it's all, a lot of it is very productive farmland. And the Acheo were caught in the middle of this because they used to live here. This was all their ancestral land. And the Brazilians from this side, Paraguayans from this side, just completely destroyed the whole way of life, their world. In the 70s, that's when the Aches started to become contacted. And most of it was not on purpose. It was not on their terms. It was a forced contact. So in the 70s, they built a road between the capital, Asunción, and Ciudad del Este right here, where they built the largest hydroelectric dam in human history until that point. There's a second bigger one now, a bigger one now in China, but until 2004, it was still the largest feat of engineering in history. And so they needed thousands and thousands of workers, so they built this road between the capital and Brazil. And that effectively divided the tribe in two, the northern Aché and the southern. And the northern Aché were the first ones to be contacted. And it did not go well. The government hired a professional hunter, a man who specialized in hunting down Aché. And he was in charge of this government reservation where they dumped all the Aché of the north there and basically just turned a blind eye to his abuses. He had his own little harem of women that, you know, he picked from the new arrivals to use for his own personal gratification or for his cronies, mostly in the military and in the the government. And this was during the dictatorship. So they would turn a blind eye to such things. But later on, the Aceh went through a genocide where first contact diseases completely ravaged the whole group because they had no immunity to measles or, you know, smallpox or to chickenpox. And just a common cold and the flu, things like that would just kill hundreds. And around 1972, just hundreds and hundreds of people died from there. And we estimate that the tribe as a whole was reduced to less than 400 people. And so people tried to escape from there. These are pictures from, they are on Survival International's website, because today there's still some legal proceedings right now. We're trying to make the government acknowledge the genocide. The military dictatorship already passed. It was overthrown in 1989, but still people don't want to recognize that this is part of our history. And so people who survived managed to go to different places. There's other communities, villages that were started after this, and the government finally shut down the reservation. And there's still a village there today that had missionary presence for a while, but the effects of this has been utterly devastating. And we're still dealing with a lot of the situations today. And so in this context comes the story of my family, the Fosterville family. These are my grandparents, Rolf and Irene Fosterville, my dad Bjarni, my aunt Luelle. This was in around 1960, I think, a picture from their missionary support card, prayer card. These were a family that moved into the jungle, these crazy gringos, coming in the middle of this the situation, and their heart was to reach the southern Aceh that still were uncontacted. So this is them in 1954. Around that time, it was in 1953, I believe. That a missionary from Paraguay came up to where they were doing training for the mission field to teach a class, and he told them about the situation of the Aceh, back then known as the Guajaki, which is an enemy name from other tribes in the area that basically translates to forest rats. But they call themselves, the real name is Aceh. So he told them about the situation that they were going through, and so they felt the call. And so they prepared, and for 15 years they served as missionaries in Bolivia and in western Paraguay among different tribes, and participated in a lot of the in different contact missions with different other tribes in South America. And that's through that they saw a lot of the best and the worst of missions at the time. And finally in 1962, they decided to go down to Paraguay full-time as to reach the Aceh. And in 1969, they bought this vehicle, a Army-issued Jeep, in North Dakota, and drove it down to Paraguay. So just to give you kind of an image, North Dakota to Paraguay. In 1969. So this was they were just crazy people. It took them 3 months. I made on Google Maps, I just measured the distance in a straight line, and it's more than 5,600 miles. So I can't even imagine if you take in all the different routes they had to go. They say that my dad remembers, he was around 6 at the time, that they were going through Guatemala City at night, in the middle of a military coup, and you know, as all the chaos is going around, there's his family with all, American family with all their belongings and everything, making their way down to South America. And at every military checkpoint, my grandfather would pray like crazy, and they get through, and they get through, and they get through. And the last thing he remembers is just seeing the lights of Guatemala City disappear in the background as they made it through. So there's a lot of stories of crazy stories of God's providence through that. And so finally, in around 1970, they settled in this area of Paraguay, in the southern part, where the Eche were still uncontacted. And they met up with this, through a very random occurrence, well, more like a divinely orchestrated coincidence. They met up with this Brazilian businessman who had a factory canning wild palm heart. So, the palm trees, core, that can be canned, and you can get it at some different international stores, probably even around here. Very big in Thai cuisine as well. And the problem was, he would send his workers into the jungle to cut down the palm trees, but the Eche would beat them to it. And so he asked our family if he'd be able to contact the Eche, because he was going under. Eventually, he decided to leave the whole industry alone anyway and turn to farming. But through that, he allowed my grandparents to stay in this old abandoned logging port that back in the 1920s or so, people would just throw logs down the river, but they had been deserted, and they built their house there. And in those days, this was the main road north-south, where hundreds of immigrants were coming by all the time, and also the roads were just nearly impassable. So the mud was just awful. They told me that when someone would go traveling, they'd always be sure to take about four or five things in their car: a shovel, a few planks of wood, an extra can of gas, a chainsaw, and a chain to pull yourself out, because it was just tunnels of jungle. And it was right in the beginning when people were starting to clear it out. So by having their house right there, a lot of Brazilian people would come by, and they'd get stuck in the mud, and you'd try to get them out, and if it was just too much, they would be able to stay at the house with them. And like, my dad would play the guitar, my aunt would play the harp, my grandfather would preach, and my grandmother would cook and pass out tracts. And that way they kind of got to know the locals, people moving into the area. And every time that they came through, they asked them if they had seen any signs of the Eche. And it's through one such lead that they heard, that's the bridge right there where they would always fix. But it was through one such lead that they heard about Lorenzo Crachoggi. Lorenzo was a former slave who, as a maybe around 13 years old, his band of Ache were ambushed by hunters. The people who resisted were shot. Everybody else were tied with barbed wire, and he was traded for a milking cow at a local city. He grew up doing all the heavy labor in this poor Paraguayan's house. Of course, it was slavery was illegal, but they just hid behind words like, "He's my adopted son." And basically, we got away with it. And this was a very common practice throughout that time. In fact, we still get many people showing up at the villages today and saying, "I used to be Ache, but as a child I was abducted, and They never told me about it, but I always knew I was different. So I'm here to try to find my family. And so he worked for many, many years as doing all the heavy labor until my grandfather heard about him and managed to have him rescued from his Paraguayan master. And after that, he became the guide and interpreter, and really the most key person in this whole story, because he knew how to track the Aché. The Aché were incredibly elusive. They were masters of their environment. They knew how to get away. There was actually quite a few misconceptions of thinking that the Aché had no toes. They were double-heeled. Because when the Aché noticed that somebody was following them, they would walk in single file, everyone stepping in the same footstep, and then send someone back to step in the same footsteps, but the other way. So you didn't really know where the toes were. You didn't know which way they were going. And so that led to the myth that they didn't have normal feet, or that their feet were backwards, stuff like that. But Lorenzo was able he knew how to track the Aché. And so for 5 years, my dad, my grandparents, mostly my grandfather, Lorenzo Gnachogi, and a Paraguayan colleague called Alejo Benitez would go into the jungle for weeks on end, following the tracks of the Aché, trying to catch up and have a face-to-face encounter with them. But they are absolutely terrified because of all the horrible things that had happened to them. In those 5 years, they only had 7 face-to-face contacts. And 5 of those were in the last year. So for about 4 years, they only had 2 contacts. But at every time that they met up, my grandfather would insist, "You are invited to come out to where we are, where the two rivers meet, and that's a place where you will be safe." And so, as the forest was being cut down, disease was always, a lingering shadow, and malnutrition was starting to take really big effect because disruption of ecosystems and of animals going around. Finally, in 1976, the Southern Aché accepted the invitation, and in October they came out of the forest and settled in the place where we are now. They came out with no knowledge of the outside world, and this is where the ministry really started really began. Everything else before this was a prelude. These were the last of the Southern Aché, only 28 people. And this is a few years later, after about 4 children were born. So this was the total size of our village, the Southern Aché that were contacted. And then with the Northern Aché who survived, it was less than 400 people. And so it was a process of gradually, first of all, gradually giving them that immunity that they needed. So for 2 years, they quarantined them, not allowing anyone to visit except if they were a doctor or themselves as a family. And it was providing them the food that they needed providing them the health, the healthcare, vaccinations and stuff like that. There's a Mennonite clinic about 4 hours away that was instrumental for this. They really were the ones who came to bat for us, because at the time my grandparents were independent missionaries because their previous mission organization thought it was not worth enough, worthwhile. That was pre-contacts, before the Aché came out. They thought it was a waste of time. There was not enough people, so they had to break away. And people came in, stepped in, like the Mennonite clinic was really incredible to fill in that gap. And then in 1982, they joined CMML. And then So this was the first cesarean that they needed to do. And then came buying the land, which was to provide them a safe place to live, a secure place to live. Because before that, it was just living off the land that was borrowed by this Brazilian businessman. But, you never knew if that could change or not. So buying the land was instrumental of giving them a safe place to be. And then it was teaching them about the outside world and different concepts. This is my mom right there in 1984, I think it was. She was a teacher who came to a local school nearby, and my dad asked her to come teach with the Aceh. She did, she loved it. When my dad started seeing how her passion and love for the Aceh was very genuine, he became very interested in her, and one thing led to the next, and I'm here today. But I was basically teaching them the concepts that were never relevant in the forest, sort of things like, wearing clothes. In the first years, they never forced them to wear clothes, except if some outsiders would come and they said, "Well, I know you guys, don't wear clothes, but they have hang-ups about that. So if you just wear it, it'll ease it off, ease the transition right there." Then came also just teaching them basic things like reading and writing, geography, putting them in the context of where they are, context of the country, of the continent, of money, or the basics of finance. And they opened up their first bank account as a community, because it was a gradual process of teaching them these things. And they had no personal property in the forest except for their bows and arrows. Everything else was shared. The whole community system is reciprocal sharing. I share with you, you'll share with me, and that way everyone covers their needs. So it's kind of trying to adapt that culture into the current culture as well, trying to learn these skills. And instrumental with this was agriculture. First started with just a stick in the ground, poke a hole, put in a seed, cover it with your foot, move on. Then came with more, as the years went by, using more tools and tractors, and it was starting to learn those skills from the Western world, which they needed to survive, because the forest was being cut down and they couldn't survive and on that the old way anymore. So trying to keep it alive as much as possible, but realizing that they would need to adapt in order to survive. So Puerto Vara today is a much different place. This is my dad, Bjarni, and Lorenzo Krachogi. This is a few years ago. Now today, the Aceh are very successful farmers. This is all our soybeans right there, our fields. There are six communities right now. These are the northern Aceh that survived and established new communities there. This is the old reservation where there's still people there. Ipetemi is the southernmost, and this is us. We're the smallest, but also the most prosperous community. This is the village in 1982, and 28 people were living there. But now we've grown to 250 in 2018. And it's growing. It's one of the fastest growing communities, indigenous groups in Paraguay. This is the technology we use with really high yields. Soybeans is our cash crop. But we also have chickens, milk, meat from pigs, and fish. And this is what the village looks like today. And this is where I grew up. I was born in 94. How could I forget that? 94. We moved back to Paraguay in 98. I was born in Paraguay, but kind of grew up a little bit in the States. So I don't really know what my mother tongue is because I kind of grew up in the States, but we always speak Spanish in the house, so I'm kind of divided on that. But my sister, that's my little sister right there. And these are the people I grew up with. I used to go between four cultures in a day because we had we were going to the local school outside where we had the Paraguayan system and Paraguayan teachers, but I'd go to school with all my Brazilian friends and then come back to play with the Ache, and then come back to my house, where my mom is Paraguayan, my dad's American, but he's kind of a mix as well because he grew up in Paraguay. And so, yeah, it was just a big swirl of different places. When I became a teenager, I started working at the pig farm for many years. And but in 2013, I decided to move to the U.S. For school. I went to Moody Bible Institute and graduated last year in 2017 with a degree in communications and Bible. And for most of my life, I felt a missionary call to work with the Ache, but I was a little bit terrified of that, particularly because with the transition from, you know, going from Stone Age to Digital Age in 40 years, there's a lot of complexities, and our ministry is very, very big because it's not just the spiritual, it's also the social and the economical, because, you know, if you only attend to the spiritual side, you know, they'll go hungry and beg on the streets, and then you deal with, you know, all the fallout from that. And so my grandparents and my parents' ministry is really trying to, you know, not let that happen. Give them that dignity that they need. And so for me, stepping into that role was just a very terrifying prospect. But over my time at Moody, it really started to click that it's not really about me. It's about the ministry. It's about God. God was starting to remove some of these fears. And so now I'm going back in October as a full-time missionary back in Puerto Varas. And so I'm starting to become the third generation now, working there. But this concept of three generations, which is happening in Puerto Varas right now with the first generation that came out of the forest, now the younger generation that's rising, with three generations in my family, this is a pattern that goes throughout most places in the world. You see that in like a family-owned business. You know, the parents start a business, maybe a bakery. The children grow up kind of working there, and many times one might stay for a while to take care of it while their parents are aging and can't do all the work. But then comes the third generation, and that's where it's the crucial moment, whether or not it'll continue or they'll close the business and do something different. Where you see that in movements. Usually there's... in June, I went to the missionary orientation program for CMML. And one of the speakers there was talking about missions and talking about different kinds of institutions that usually arise and the difference between movements and institutions. Movements usually happen when, say, a group of friends get together and they say, "Oh, let's go and do evangelism once a month in different neighborhoods, a new neighborhood every time," and so they do that, and it's very successful, and they enjoy it, and so they said, "We'll do this every month," and soon, you know, over the years, they start to codify different, you know, people know who are more better in certain areas, and so they start developing a leadership, and then suddenly this becomes an institution, because now there's rules and regulations. And new people are attracted to that. This is the second generation of leaders who start taking care of it. But it's usually the third generation of new leaders after the second one that are need to know if they're going to follow and do that or just close this ministry and do something different. In the same, you know, so this pattern repeats across different places, in churches, in families, everywhere. And I would like to bring to attention one very specific case in the book of Joshua. So you guys know this very famous verse. You can see it on calendars, on plates, you hang it up on walls or whatever. It's very very inspiring. But the context is very important in this. So if you guys would like to open the Bible at Joshua 24. And in this context of this verse, this is the very end of the book of Joshua. And Joshua has been leading Israel for many, many years, and he knows he's about to die. He's lived a very full life, and it's very close to his time to go. And so he's concerned about the new generation that's coming after him. And, as we all know, generational change is a very difficult time for any place. We're seeing it right now with, the worries between baby boomers and millennials, or now the Gen Z that's, they're starting to become teenagers, and everyone likes to talk about the differences, and they're worrying about what they'll do to the workforce. So these kind of concerns are very normal in any person's in any community, and so Joshua in chapter 24 he calls together all the people of Israel and all their leaders, and he talks to them and says and starts telling the story of their people, how Abraham was called to come to Canaan, how they were rescued from Egypt and they parted the Red Sea, how as they came up through the wilderness, they were able to defeat their enemies, and then they came into the Promised Land, and Jericho fell, and all the different alliances of their enemies always failed. And he says that and now you are living in this land with all these benefits and the blessings, that the promises that God had made to you have all been fulfilled. And we come to verse 14, and Joshua, being the first generation of people, he says to the new leaders, now therefore fear the Lord and serve him in sincerity and faithfulness. Put away the gods of your fathers served beyond the river and in Egypt, and serve the Lord. And if it is evil in your eyes to serve the Lord, choose this day whom you will serve, whether the gods your fathers served in the region beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. So he's basically challenging the new generation. What will you do? You've seen all the benefits, and I've told you all the things that God has done for you. And now you're in this place of great blessing because of what God has done for you. But you still have to make a commitment. Will you follow God, or will you turn to the idols and gods of this land? But he says, I will serve the Lord. And he's no stranger to doing this alone. He's no stranger to the cost of doing this. Because if you'll remember, when Israel first arrived at the border of Canaan, they were ready to take the land, but they were afraid. And they decided to rebel against God and go back to Egypt. And the only two people who stood against this and said, no, believe the word of the Lord and be faithful to him, were Joshua and Caleb. And they nearly died for their troubles. And they're the only ones who survived from that generation. Everyone else died in the wilderness in the 40 years of wandering. So he knows that this is not an easy decision to make. And so in this context, you can probably put the same, you can make the same analogy to the first generation of the Aceh. These were the people who had been in the forest, had seen the horrors of the disease ravaging them, and the insecurities. And when they came out to Puerto Varra, that's when they heard the gospel preached by my grandfather, who was also a first-generation person in our family. And they heard the gospel, and they said, well, yeah, this makes sense. Because in the forest, they used to worship and fear spirits and of animals and ancestors and different things like that. But they would look up at the stars, and they would say, we know that someone created all this, but we don't know who. And so when they heard the gospel, that's when it finally clicked. So this is who we are looking for. And it changed their whole world. And the Aceh came together as a group, collectively, to faith in Christ. And today, the older generation are still the most dedicated people in the church. And so there comes the second generation. And we skip over to verse 16. Then the people answered, far be it from us that we should forsake the Lord and serve other gods. For it is the Lord our God who brought us and our fathers up from the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery, and who did these great signs in our sight and preserved us all the way that we went and among all the peoples through whom we passed. And the Lord drove out before us all the people and the Amorites who lived in the land. Therefore we will also serve the Lord, for he is our God. But it's interesting right here in verse 19, it says, but Joshua said to the people, you're not able to serve the Lord, for he is a holy God. He is a jealous God. He will not forgive your transgressions or your sins. If you forsake the Lord and serve foreign gods, then he will turn and do you harm and consume you for after having done you good. And the people said to Joshua, no, but we will serve the Lord. So Joshua seems a bit of a downer right here, but he's just recognizing the fact without really, first of all, counting the cost and depending on God, we can't serve the Lord in our human brokenness. It is only through really depending on the Lord for his grace that we'll be able to serve him completely. And he's basically saying, count the cost. There are going to be consequences if they're in of sin. And so the people take heed of this warning and they decide that they're going to follow God anyway. And so this is the second generation. And at the end right there it says, and Israel served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua and had known all the works that the Lord had made. They made that commitment. And this is the second generation in our village right now. The young men and women who were there that came out of the forest in their teens and are now the current leadership today. And my parents are as well. They're the second generation. And it was in this generation that the New Testament was translated into Aceh and given out to them. And they've served the Lord, but with their own failings and difficulties. But they still are trying. But then comes the third generation. And we come over to Judges. We skip over to Judges 2:17. And between verse 6 and 10, we get this basically a repeat, almost word for word, from the very last paragraphs of the book of Joshua, basically saying he died, and then the generation after him died as well. And then in verse 10, and all that generation were also gathered to their fathers, the second generation. And there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord or the work that he had done for Israel. And unfortunately, the very next verse in verse 11, it says, and the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and served the Baals. So there's a disconnect right here. Somehow, this new generation did not know what God had done for them and what he had, the mighty deeds. And they looked around at the gods of their neighbors, the environment of which they were, and thought that that was more attractive. And so they went down the wrong path, and they suffered a lot of the consequences. We see this in the whole book of Judges, of the constant back and forth between, you know, serving different gods, experiencing the consequences of sin, crying out for God, and then generation after generation, there's this constant back and forth. And you can see that this third generation did not make that commitment that the second generation did. And so in our village, this is the third generation that we're facing today as well, which I'm a part of that one as well. I grew up with them. They're the new generation of leaders growing up. They're starting their own families. They're starting to adopt, become part of these positions of leadership and influence. And right now we're in this position. Where, you know, which side do they go to? Because the idols of the current world, the consumerism and the worldliness and promiscuity and all that stuff, that is very attractive for the younger generation. And these are people who have grown out of the forest. They don't communicate very well with their grandparents because of this. There's a breakdown in the language. They're speaking a mixture of the different languages around us and not so much Aceh. And there's a change in the values. Yet they're also very, very passionate. They want to become lawyers and farmers and engineers. You know, the sky's the limit. But they, with this, there's a problem right now where they're starting to try to figure out where they live. How do they live out their cultural identity in a world where everybody else around them says that's not good enough? That they have to ditch everything from the past and adopt everything from, you know, today. And it's all about adopting the worst of our surrounding societies, you know, the vices and everything of that. So how do they keep their Aceh identity alive in this context? And so our biggest challenge today is just basic integrity. Corruption is one of the biggest problems we face in Paraguay, and it's starting to seep in within our own community. And it's just lack of integrity in the financial, with leaders skimming a little bit off the top for their own personal gain, or lack of integrity within the family, not being honest or faithful to their wives. And these are some of the big challenges that we're facing today. And this is where the third generation really needs to decide, individually but also collectively, who will they serve? Will they commit to following God wholeheartedly or not? And that's basically my ministry going back there today. Having grown up with them, I am part of that third generation. And I'm right now in that process. I'm making the commitment to following God wholeheartedly by going back and serving with them. It's not easy. And there is a cost involved. But it is what God has called me to do. And I don't want to see my generation commit the mistakes that some of their parents have done, or to adopt the mistakes of the surrounding people around them. I don't want to see them pass through that level of heartbreak for no reason. And I want to see the Aceh become passionate for the gospel and live it out fully and experience those benefits from that and be able to share it with other people, other tribes and other nations. And so this is a story of three generations, of my grandparents, my parents right there. These are my older brother and my younger sister on both sides of me right there. And now me, going back. And this is Lorenzo Crachogi. He's about 80 years old now. We don't really know because he was born in the forest and they didn't keep track of time right there. But he's still alive. He's still working hard. He's still cutting wood and working every day. And he's just is an amazing example to the many generations. So it's a challenge for you guys as well. Where do you, every one of you, situate yourself in this timeline? Are you first generation, people who first learned about the gospel and now are trying to live a different life and are setting up a legacy for the future generations? Or are you inheritors of a legacy of living the gospel? And what will you do? What commitments will you make to that? Because every generation has that decision to make, and it has to be made individually, but it also can be done communally, because we all need help in this walk. We need to bear each other's burdens, and we need to help each other stay faithful, accountable, and encouraged as we try to follow God with all of our strength and hearts and minds. And so that's a challenge for you as well, to analyze where you are in this situation, where the church here is in that generational timeline as well. But I'll just finish with one last image right here. This is my grandmother right there. She and my grandfather came to the States in 92 because of heart problems. My grandfather had mal de Chagas, or Chagas disease, which is, it basically inflames your heart to twice its size, with all different types of heart problems with that. So unfortunately, he was never able to come back to visit the Aceh and see the changes that have happened there. But my grandmother, in 2014, we were able to move her down, and she spent her last 2 years with us. And this was on her 90th birthday. And she's surrounded by all the different generations. First, second, third, even the fourth right now, and fifth. And this is the birthday cake they made for her. And it's just an amazing picture, because rarely do you see, as in one image, the effect that one person can have throughout their life. And she was a person who was always preaching. Even when she was 90 years old, she'd pass out tracts. And so it's just an image of, I believe, of how we'll be able to see the effect that every one of us will have one day when we reach heaven, or maybe even if God is kind enough to show us even today. Just one life lived for Christ can affect so many people. And I hope that will be the same thing for us and for me as well as I go back. So yeah. I had one more video to show, just kind of the life in Puerto Varra, but I think my time is over. But if you guys are flexible, all right. So this is to kind of just show this is what it's like to live in Puerto Varra. And these are the people that I'm going to live with. I went back after nearly 3 years of being away. For the first time in 3 years, I was back last month in Paraguay to visit. And I saw a lot of the changes. There's a lot of new houses there. There's about 40 new houses that were built because the community is growing like crazy. And so I don't know where anybody lives anymore, so I'm very disoriented. I have to ask all the kids, where does that person live? Over there, by that person. Where does that person live? And on it goes. But my first weekend there was a really great celebration where we had a wedding and two quinceañeras and a one-year-old birthday. And they made this cake that was just enormous. It was even bigger than the one for my grandmother. So I'd just like to share it with you guys.
Well, good morning. Today is the big day. There's going to be a lot of celebrations today. There's one wedding, two 15th birthdays, and the birthday of my friend Pablo's one-year-old son. So yeah, it's been crazy. last night we got here to the community, and the whole day has been spent trying to make preparations for this. There's the girls are getting ready and getting all of their hair stuff.
Yeah, that's so my sister right there doing the hair.
I'm excited. It's going to be a very, very nice day.
So there's the groom getting ready. And the bride. So that was the 1-year-old, the two 15-year-old girls, and I was asked to be a godfather for one of them in the procession, then the couple right there. So that's my dad preaching right there. So now they're married. You have to feed about 250 people, so there's. Potato salad, just in case.
laughing and eating, having a lot of cake. And yeah, it's been wonderful to be back home. And despite the rain and the cold and all of that, we just had a great time together. And boy, it's nice to be back home.
So yeah, that's the village right there. Those are the people. And that's where the ministry is going to be at. So, yeah. All right, so I'll just close out in prayer. All right. Sorry. So, dear Lord, I thank you for the time you've given me to be here and be able to speak about this. I thank you for your blessings as well, Lord. And I pray, Lord, specifically for this congregation right here, for all the different challenges that they face, and the pressures and the different complexities here too, Lord. But Lord, I just pray that every one of us will be challenged to make that commitment with you, Lord. Because sometimes it's easy to forget about our first love, Lord. And I pray that the people here who have maybe slid or need to come back closer to you, Lord, will be able to do that. You'll bring them closer. Or if they haven't given their lives yet, entrusted you completely. Or today is the day then. May they be able to experience your grace fully and the joy that comes with that. But Lord, I thank you for the many blessings that you have done in all of our lives who believe in you. The many deeds you have done. Whether it is in our families' lives, or the testimonies that we have, either from our grandparents or even in ourselves. But Lord, just the benefits that we enjoy through you, communion with you, Lord, being able to come to your presence and enjoy a relationship with you. That when you died on that cross, you took away our sins. You became sin for us. So Lord, I pray that we never will forget that and live accordingly, Lord. Live accordingly too, in light of the fact that we have been redeemed and purchased with your precious blood. And Lord, may that stir us to always live for you and keep searching for your will and to reach more people for you, Lord. And may we never forget the cost, but also never forget the joy and the hope that we have. So Lord, I just pray that you will protect every one of us today and everyone here the rest of this week as well. In your name we pray. Amen.